It's 8:06 on this Tuesday, December 29th. 9 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, very cold start to the day, and we're going to be even colder heading into tomorrow, as we'll actually see more clear skies than even what we saw here this morning. So prepare for near zero for the overnight low tomorrow morning. But we'll only get into the low 20s today in Park City for those daytime highs under partly cloudy skies. We'll be slightly warmer by the time we get to the Thursday time frame. It would be in the upper 20s, but we are then at that point talking about more snow. Now, that snow that's coming in on Thursday, which is New Year's Eve day, it doesn't look great. Even for our mountains, it's actually becoming weaker by each model run that is being outputted and looking more like, unfortunately, diving south. So though we may see a little bit of snow, it's not going to be too exciting for those that are looking for fresh snow for the mountains. Even though we picked up 4 inches at Park City Mountain today, that was good news. So we've got to wait longer, and that doesn't look like it's going to be until the end of the weekend into Monday. So we'll stay in the 20s pretty much all weekend long until that next storm comes in. That will bring in a little bit more in the way of some south flow, some warmer air ahead of that storm. So we'll warm up into the mid-30s ahead of it, and then we'll chill back down behind it. But we still will stay all snow in Park City for that one, and that will lead to accumulating snow both for the Park City proper and also for the mountains. So and then behind that, more snow in terms of more storms as well, all the way through what looks to be next week. So that's good news that the snow train keeps going. But as we wind down 2020, Salt Lake City will end up having what, top five driest in the history of the city since record keeping began in 1874 over the annual span of time, which is not good news, and that doesn't bode well for our drought that's ongoing.
No, sure doesn't. Okay, Adam, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Thank you.
And with a look in the backcountry from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, I've got Drew on the line. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. We've dawned clear. Winds mercifully have notched down overnight as the storm barrels off to the south and east of us. Storm total is about 1 to 3 inches, probably the lion's share over there on the backside of Park City. The Provo Area Mountains also did fairly well on the south side of Provo Canyon. They picked up a half inch of water, about 7 or 8 inches over there. Elsewhere, just maybe a trace to two. The danger remains considerable, primarily mid and upper elevations, sort of west to north to east, for avalanches failing into the old snow from November. Wind slabs also sort of complicate matters, particularly with unusual east winds, and those tend to catch people off guard. And you might find those probably more pronounced on steep north to west to south facing slopes, and even at the mid-elevations. Number of the anemometers were also quite gusty at the mid-elevations or even well off the ridgelines. So it'll be a day to continue to mind your slope angles, generally 30 degrees and less. And remember, you can trigger these avalanches on approach or even from below. So that's the big picture, Leslie, from the backcountry.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Drew.
Thanks.
KPCW News Time now, 8:10. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a minute, we'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher with a look back at 2020 and what's ahead for next year. Then Don Sargent is chairman of the Eastside Planning Commission. He's also a private planner. He talks a little bit about the Wohale project and other projects being considered there on the east side. Finally, Aaron Ferguson with Save People, Save Wildlife talks about the success of the wildlife bridge that was installed back in November of 2018 and the next efforts underway to fence areas along Interstate 80. Stay tuned. And right after the local news hour, stay tuned for This Green Earth. Nate Brown talking about the 10th annual Utah Birders Park City Christmas Bird Count, its origins and purpose, when it's held, and how you can join in this coming Sunday, January 3rd. Then conversation with Walt Meyer, a senior research scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data, provides an update on the growth and conditions of sea ice up in the Arctic, and while 2020 saw a near record level of sea ice melt. All of that coming up on today's edition of
this green earth.
It's 8:12 now. Good morning. Well, joining me now on the phone with a look back at some of Summit County's achievements and challenges this year, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom. There you are. Thanks for joining us. So, what do you think the County Council's major accomplishment was for 2020?
Well, you know, the county as a whole, you know, the major accomplishment, I think, is really continuing to move this the strategic direction of the county. And, of course, I'm talking from kind of a 30,000-foot level, but while everything else was happening, you know, the two major things that took up time this year, certainly the COVID-19 pandemic and all the county response to that, and really the whole community response to that, that was organized by so many. And then, you know, certainly some of the annexation issues that took up a really good amount of time for about 3 or 4 months during the year.
Yeah. So how do you think the county did handle the COVID-19 pandemic?
Well, I think we did as good as we possibly could have. I really commend our health department, our leadership at the health department, and of course our political leadership that backed up what our folks felt was the right thing to do. You know, the early response, certainly, you know, we saw this both locally and nationwide. The early response was the right response in trying to stop the spread, and we were successful in doing that. I know not everybody agreed with the methods that were in place, but you know, really, if you look back at what Summit County was promoting along the way, even state and local governments around our own area and then nationally seemed to follow that same track over time as the science was pointing in that direction.
So in terms of staying on task with the strategic plan, I mean, you think we did okay? We moved that forward and didn't go kind of sideways given all of the other stuff?
You know, it's remarkable because of how counties have to organize around emergencies, and as extensive and long term as this one was, you know, really for the first 3 or 4 months, we were reallocating resources that would normally go towards transportation and library and sustainability, community planning, all those different areas that we are involved in. We were reallocating some of those resources towards the emergency itself and still kept a lot of projects going and really stayed on our work plan as much as possible. At the same time, you know, we early saw the reality of what this emergency was going to do to our economy. And we made major budget adjustments to do that or in reaction to that, which also changed what we were going to accomplish during the year.
Let's talk a little bit about transportation and congestion. That's part of the county's strategic plan. For anybody who was in the traffic last night, they know that it took maybe 50 minutes to get to the grocery store. I know that it took somebody an hour and a half to get from the Park West area to Kearns Boulevard.
Yeah, you know, it certainly is true that with our heavy days, whether they and they usually include a weather event as well as our heavy tourism days, we still have issues to deal with, and that's why, you know, certainly on the county side, and we know our local governments are united on working on transportation issues. So, you know, with that, throughout the year, we have continued to push towards expanding our transit services. Even though we're in a time period where our transit services are reduced, we're looking to the future and what transit is going to be in the future to deal with congestion. We led an RFP or led a contract this year to advance the environmental clearance for our bus rapid transit system that's going to come on 224 in the future. And we continue to plan for regional type service with talks that we're having with Wasatch County at this point. as well as road projects. The Jeremy Ranch Interchange was finished this year, which not only accommodates vehicle traffic in the future, is really there to, part of the impetus of that project is to move transit better in the future and not have that interchange be a bottleneck, as well as the pedestrians and bicycles because of the tunnels that we put in with that project. The council decided on a right-of-way for a connection between the Bittner area and Silver Creek that will probably start to see construction either this next year or the year after. So, you know, we continue to work on these issues even while other things have taken precedence.
Okay, so you don't think that connector road at Silver Creek will get underway this year, the coming year?
It all depends on how the right-of-way acquisition process goes at the beginning of this next year. We've got some preliminary designs and surveying done in order to pursue right-of-way, and sometimes that it's sometimes tough to judge how long that will take.
All right. And then with the county moving forward with its own transit district, there's a lot of work to do there, but you've kind of got a deadline of like June, right?
We do. The end of June is when we're projected to take on services within the county and bring those operations to that new transit district. So we have a timeline laid out, and you've seen us following that timeline. The first step was kind of reforming that transit district so that it has its own board and continue to work on its own projects. And so you're going to see more of that over the next 6 months, culminating in that operations turnover in June.
All right. And then back to the strategic plan. What about workforce housing? Where did we make movement there?
Well, you know, certainly we've continued on that, a lot of it through some of the projects that are coming through the planning process. You know, certainly Silver Creek Village, we're starting to see quite a few affordable units come out of the ground with another project that came through the planning process that we'll probably see come out of the ground next year. Lincoln Station is being built, which has affordable units within it. The CVMA and the workforce housing that's associated with the development agreement at the Canyons is all permitted and ready to begin construction. Woodward finished up their workforce housing units associated with their project. The Discovery project is moving forward. And then the last project that was projected in the New Park area, which turned out to be affordable units is also being done. But you know, we're also very active at the state level. We're working with a task force that continues to advise the legislature on workforce housing issues. It's not just an issue here in Summit County or Park City, it's all over the state that these issues crop up, and we know it's a nationwide issue as well. And then, you know, we've continued to be compliant with having our moderate income housing plan adopted each year so that we can stay current with what the needs are in Summit County.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what that task force is looking at? I mean, some of the things that Park City Municipal has done is reduce parking requirements, reduced setbacks, you know, additional height, things like that. Is that what we're talking about?
I'm not sure if it's that granular. I think they're looking at it more. You know, how can they help local governments make perhaps more land available to affordable housing? Change the way regulations are done or the way that planning processes are done in order to move those projects through the process faster. They're also working on it, you know, they're also working on it from the perspective of what can they put in place to encourage local governments to take on more projects. And not that the local government never necessarily builds the projects, but is not an impediment to getting affordable housing done within their community.
And what progress have we made on sustainability and environmental stewardship?
Well, quite a bit, actually. You know, the whole idea of setting out goals a few years ago in conjunction with Park City Municipal to have 100% renewable electricity for our government operations. That project probably will come to fruition. I mean, we've seen a lot of progress from the regulatory side this year, as well as letting contracts to actually build the solar project that will support that for not only many municipalities or counties, but also for some private businesses. That project is going to come to fruition probably in 2022, 2023, which will put it 7 or 8 years faster than we thought it could be accomplished. And then also, we continue to work on 100% renewable energy availability for our whole Summit County community, along with other municipalities that are doing that within Summit County. We're all doing that together. It's certainly a longer process, and probably we won't see major progress on that until the end of this decade. But we're making progress, and it continues to make its way through the Public Service Commission and working with the legislature to see what the possibilities are of offering that for our whole community.
And another priority in the strategic plan is mental health and substance abuse issues. Of course, it was 2019, I believe, when the county actually contracted with the University of Utah. Is that moving forward as well?
Absolutely. I mean, that contract, again, was renewed this year for another period, and I'm not going to remember the exact period of time, but multi-year. And, you know, we're pleased with the progress of that contract and the provider in what they're what they promised to do moving into business with them, and then what they've actually produced. And along with that, they've one of the big accomplishments that they helped expand was coverage of school-based services, especially with our high schools. So that's a big win for that contract with the University of Utah. But another accomplishment under mental health was the establishment of the Regional Stabilization and Crisis Intervention Unit. And that's a joint project between Wasatch County and Summit County, with some state funding involved with it as well. It will eventually, or this year, will be housed here in Summit County. It's already begun its work. It's currently housed in Wasatch County, but it will make that move here during the year.
The council did approve the Kimball Junction Master Plan back in 2019, but did not decide if Dakota Pacific fits that plan. You expect that to happen early next year?
Well, we're certainly going to keep processing it. You know, we have a public hearing scheduled in January, as well as more meetings with the Dakota Pacific team in front of the council. You know, planning issues are going to continue. You know, Hideout is an example. We've got a lot of different applications that are approaching us, both on the west side of the county and on the east side of the county, that are going to challenge some of the assumptions that our general plans and our codes contemplate. And for that purpose, our planning commissions are going to be going through quite an extensive review of our general plans this year, as well as trying to tackle some nagging subjects within our code. One of those being accessory buildings. We've seen those issues come up with rather large accessory buildings being contemplated in several places. And many other issues, especially around water quality, that the council is asking the planning commissions to take on this year.
Okay. Any news with regard to the Hideout annexation?
I think we're just watching some of the litigation make its way through the process. As well, you know, we're starting to engage with some parties, continuing to engage with others on subjects around transportation and future land use planning in the area of Wasatch County and where Wasatch County meets Summit County. All of these issues are tied together, and we need to engage parties across the county lines, service providers across the county lines, because we know there's a lot of pressure coming. It's already here, and more is coming that we have to deal with.
Finally, I just wanted to ask you about the state of Utah celebrating the anniversary of statehood on Monday, January 4th. Each county was called on to kind of throw its own celebration. Is Summit County doing anything?
Well, we're facilitating, kind of the celebration that was contemplated by the state is that they have contracted with a provider to do some fireworks within the county be part of that celebration. That's how we're participating. We're helping them find a spot to do that and permitting them to do that. It's going to be in the area of the open space and the Dakota Pacific land, actually along the trail that's there. So it will be able to be viewed from, if you want to drive or park in some of the parking lots in the new park area or around the area of our transit center, that's where we'll be conducting that celebration.
Okay, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I'm just looking forward to a great 2021. We know that the pandemic will continue to be a major driving force around county work this year, but we are still pretty ambitious around all of our strategic priorities and want to continue pushing those because we know that's what sets up Summit County to be successful in the future.
Okay. Hey, Tom, appreciate your call-in this morning and every Tuesday morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Happy New Year. That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning. Well, as we've reported, the Colville City Council unanimously approved the revised Mohali project. On the phone to tell us more about that, I have the chairman of the Eastside Planning Commission, Don Sargent. He also works as a private planner for this development. Good morning, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Well, good morning, Leslie. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you. So the fact that Mohali is a Colville project, no conflict of interest for you as a planning commissioner?
No, not where the project is completely within the town boundaries of Colville, and the planning commission would not be acting on it in any way. There's no conflict and interest there at all that has been determined.
Yeah. So what happens next with this project?
Well, the next step in going forward will be the finalization of the development agreement for the overall master plan development, and then the processing and review of the phase one final plat.
And you expect that to all happen then this year? I mean, any construction underway in 2021?
Yes, I think the developers are planning on trying to get something started next year, next spring, in 21. If they can come through with their final plat approval by that time, then I think they are planning on at least trying to get some of the initial infrastructure, roadways underway for the development.
Now, you served in the Summit County Planning Department for years, and certainly you have a bias as the private planner for the project, but can you talk a little bit about why you think this is a good thing for the city of Colville?
Sure. I mean, I think it's good and bad. As the planner that has been retained by the city as an outside consultant working for the city to process the application, I could see the good and the bad coming from it. Obviously, in that position, I have to remain very neutral, and so I have tried not to have any bias one way or another for or against. But in reality of it, development is needed in any town if it's done right and can support the general plan and the direction the town wants to go. In this case, given the location of this project property, where it's sort of out of sight, out of mind in terms of any visual impact and any traffic impact coming into the main street corridor, it has some merits that way to not have an impact right into the town center itself, but also have some positive benefit to the economic base of the community, which is desperately needed to help the city maintain its current level of services that they're trying to offer.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how the Colville city staff was impacted by this really very controversial and emotional controversy, I should say?
It was. It was very controversial. In fact, I have to say it's probably the most controversial project I have ever been involved with in my years of doing this. And, you know, for good and bad reasons. You know, it's a change. I think the main pushback was the perceived change that this could have on the community. And the developers were luckily very willing to try to absorb that change as much as they could in terms of trying to offer some community benefits on their initial application. The citizen group that was formed kind of put that one to bed with a referendum, and the developer proceeded with a straight-up permitted right application, which took out a lot of those community benefits that the city had negotiated with the developer, that would be open, an open community, not a closed gate community. And it was a kind of unfortunate in one way, and I guess fortunate in another way, because of the size that was reduced essentially in half, that the current application afforded the developer, and not taking the impact of services away from the city as much as the former application may have done over time. However, in this case, with some recent code amendments that were adopted previous to the initial application, the developer was 100% responsible to pay for any impacting any of the infrastructure, services, or capacities, storage, or otherwise that they would create. So in that way, we felt at the city that we had that covered, and that now we were focusing more on the impacts of the traffic, some of the on-site adjacent property impacts, making sure all the circulation worked, and timing of the development that would not take away from any service capacity levels to the existing citizens. That was kind of the direction we were going on the initial. The current one now is a straight-up permitted use, as I indicated, just like any small subdivision or major subdivision in any other part of the city. Now the city has responsibility to provide services, again, in a timely fashion, but with not as many community benefits associated with it. So it was an attempt to try to balance the impacts with the positive benefits. I think we still do have the benefits, probably mostly economic at this point, which is a doubling of the current city budget, if not more, over time as the development builds out. And again, the developer is responsible for all impact of any of the services that they will be utilizing from the city.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about some of the projects before the Eastside Planning Commission. As I mentioned, you're chairman of that. The Planning Commission looked at the Cedar Crest overlay zone in Hoytsville back in November. What was the reaction of the board members, and what's the direction here to staff?
You know, we've seen been updated twice now on the Cedar Crest overlay, just getting progress information on how the staff has been working with the committee that's been appointed to address that project. And it's been interesting. I'll put it that way. There hasn't been a lot of detailed information provided yet other than conceptual. And so, you know, we know it's about 1,000 acres in size, 21 approximately landowners involved, mixed-use development. The one thing that came out of our last meeting from one of the committee members that sit on the commission, Commissioner Bill Wild, indicated that the project is being proposed as a 5,000 unit development right now. And that was a little bit of a sticker shock for all the rest of us, not realizing that much was being anticipated for potential development units. And so that is yet to be kind of fleshed out on what that really means. But I think at this point, the direction of the commission to the staff was to get some additional public input in an informal way. Mostly, you know, with the pandemic situation, it's really difficult to have real meaningful public hearings where we can sit down or talk openly across the table to citizens. And so right now we're trying to develop a survey that can be distributed and get some initial feedback with some of the key points that we have initially been updated on, so we kind of have some sense before we schedule a formal public hearing.
Let's see, what's the latest with regard to the controversy there in Samick? There's a couple, the Sheffields, who wanted to put a trailer on their property, saying that it's for personal use. Opponents, though, say it could lead to commercial use and say it doesn't belong in a residential neighborhood.
Yeah, that was an interesting public hearing we had on that. And, you know, it's just a trend that's occurring, I think, not only in Samick, but many other of these mountain subdivisions that were initially developed as seasonal cabins and or summer use, now turning into more permanent use. People are trying to get away from the city centers and getting up more into the open air country and mountain environments. And so this is, I think, a trend that we will have to deal with. And so following that public hearing, the commission directed staff to work on some proposed amendments that we could consider for campground use in any of these subdivisions. One concern we all have on the commission is balancing the code and county regulation for these subdivisions versus the subdivision homeowner association doing it. So that's where we'll have to try to see where that balance is on how much regulation the county should be providing to assist the subdivision lot owners versus what the HOAs should be doing.
So it sounds like you will be holding a work session on this next month?
Yes, next month, Pat Todd, the Director of Community Development, indicated that we should be looking at some draft language on that, and then subsequently, obviously, we'll have an additional public hearing before anything is approved.
All right, and then also at the last meeting you had, you were introduced to a new project near Wanship. Representatives of the Blue Sky Ranch want to do a 64-lot subdivision, some farming, a pool, clubhouse, property on about 550 acres, located about north of the Blue Sky Ranch and then west of downtown Wanship. So this is separate than what was originally approved for the Blue Sky Ranch?
That's correct. This is completely new. It's adjacent to the original Blue Sky Ranch. The landowners of Blue Sky purchased or in the process of purchasing the adjacent property, as you indicated, about 551 acres. Used to be what's been known as the Ken Block parcel. It was once proposed as a racetrack for, I can't remember all the details, but the roadways are up through there as a ESPN racetrack type of use. That never came to pass, and so the property, I think, did go on the market, and then I think the owners of Blue Sky are in the process of purchasing it or have purchased it, I don't know. But this is a development proposal including a rezone of the property, a master plan development for a mixed-use, kind of high-end, sustainable mountain farm community is what has been called. Make the name for that across the country for these that are starting to come that have already been developed in this fashion are called agri-hoods. And so it's kind of a eclectic, I would say, more high-end mountain development that's that proposes sustainable green development, eating from the land, and we didn't get into a lot of that kind of detail, but that's kind of the sense of what the project is. It's kind of a resort type of community in the mountains, so similar to Dominion Park City, and even Wahali has some comparison to that, I suppose, in some way with a higher end development. Impacts that were discussed at the commission level, which was mostly the discussion that took place, was addressing water rights, water sources that would be required, and how that would be established on the property and not affect adjacent properties, wells, or other sources in the Wanship area. A big discussion topic was employee housing, providing employee housing to serve not only that development, but the other Blue Sky needs. I mean, I know a lot of residents here in Wanship, where I live, do work at the Blue Sky Ranch, and very difficult to provide housing outside the area, obviously, because of the price points. And so we were talking about how to do that locally or even on site with supporting that development need for employment. Visual impacts were discussed from Old Lincoln Highway and other areas in the Wanship area. The transition zoning was also discussed. Traffic impact was another big topic on the additional traffic that would come through Wanship up through a residential neighborhood leading up to the Blue Sky Ranch area, how that would be addressed. And then wildlife habitat was the other one that was discussed briefly, because this is a winter range for both mule deer and elk. And so there's a lot of work that still yet to be done. This is very conceptual. Right now at this level, it was more of a update work session on here's a proposal, what are the initial concerns from the commission. We communicated that to staff, and now it's up to the developer to address those items and then come back for probably an additional work session before we have a public hearing.
Okay. Lots of work ahead of you. Don, anything else anything else you want to add?
Yeah, we actually have three other things we're working on the east side. We're going to be looking at some general plan updates, trying to make sure we're being current with where things are going, and making sure that direction is still consistent with the trends we're seeing, and make sure that we're still achieving the goals and objectives and policies of what the general plan should be guiding us to do with all the other project applications. We also have a priority list we're working off of that we generated back in September. Affordable employee housing is number one on that, so that goes coincides with what we just talked about on the farms at Blue Sky. And then, as we already discussed, that development code amendment regarding campgrounds right now. There's some other development code amendments we're looking at. We'd like to relook at the master plan development provisions and just do some other cleanup amendments in the development code to make it more consistent and clear on reviewing the application.
Okay. Again, appreciate your time, Don.
Yeah, thank you, Leslie. Good to talk to you.
Don Sargent, the chairman of the Eastside Planning Commission. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the Save People, Save Wildlife organization has worked to identify dangerous roadways in Summit County for wildlife and people who hit them. On the phone with me to talk about the success they have seen this year and what's on tap for next year, I have one of the founding members, Aaron Ferguson. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, so let's just begin with a recap of the wildlife crossing bridge there at the top of Parley's Summit. Tell us what you, DWR, and UDOT have discovered since the bridge went up in the fall of 2018.
Well, I know there was some skepticism. You know, it was a very large monetary investment for them to do that, but studies showed that the animals used this area to cross back and forth across I-80. So something needed to be done. The focus is on the overpass and the successes of it. They, biologists were thinking, oh, it'll take them, you know, a couple, 3 years, maybe even eight, depending on the species, to follow the fencing, use the overpass regularly. But the animals have proved to use it at a much faster rate than anticipated. So that is very encouraging. And it also highlights the importance of them. You know, we can't just place one component of this. We can't just have a wildlife overpass, because if we don't have fencing or cattle guards, they won't be guided to the safe migration path. Again, we can't have wildlife fencing standing alone. because we can't isolate these animals from each other or access to water or food. So, you know, all the pieces in the puzzle have contributed to the success, and people are focusing on the overpass alone. But DWR's interview with the BBC USA Today, you know, did allude to the fact that there is wildlife fencing leading up to the bridge. So, so in future projects, we want to make people realize that fencing is important, yes, to keep the wildlife off of our roadways, but we can't keep them from crossing. We have to have a safe option for them to cross, and that can be an overpass, an underpass, and the like. So what we would like to do is, moving forward, time the wildlife mitigation placement with Summit County's projects that they have planned for 224, 248, Silver Creek Junction, the Kimball Junction Improvement Project. Why not have those wildlife mitigation components planned for and budgeted for in these improvement projects? It just makes sense.
Yeah. What was so cool about seeing there was some kind of time delayed video that was posted on social media, but the menagerie of animals. I mean, I'm not talking just deer and moose, but there was mountain lion, bear, raccoons. I mean, it was crazy how many different animals.
Oh, and even the smaller animals like chipmunks, squirrels, porcupines. You know, I mean, it was just fascinating to see and just to think that, you know, you're seeing the footage from the animals are crossing, but below, you know, just a few feet below them, traffic is whizzing by.
Yeah.
24/7. You know, and you know, the bobcat scratching on the log, for example, they seem very comfortable with this crossing. So it bodes well that we seriously think about appropriate placement for these in the future. You know, as soon as we put roadways in, we disrupt. And, you know, we need to take some responsibility for our actions in that regard.
Yeah. So how is your organization then using what you know to encourage other crossings?
Well, we're, you know, it's, again, you know, it's, you know, the pandemic has slowed things down, certainly. But it's very important to people. That's one of the main things we've learned, is that People want to see our wildlife preserved. They want to, you know, whether they live here seasonally or year-round, they want to see the animals and coexist with them. So the importance of it from an aesthetic standpoint and, you know, as a valuable resource, I guess, is a fair way to name it, you know, as well as an economic perspective, you know, and as well as a safety perspective. You know, it's very expensive to build these and place these wildlife mitigation components, but it's much more expensive to pay for, you know, first responders and law enforcement and, okay, a big semi-truck, you know, hits a moose on I-80 and rolls and traffic is stopped for hours. You know, those things are expensive too. So if we can take one component out of that equation, you know, the wildlife mitigation components pay for themselves in a short time.
So a study done a year or so ago showed that Summit and Wasatch County have 5 out of the 10 most deadly roads for wildlife. What's happening with 224?
Well, we in our latest meeting with UDOT, which was February of 2020, you know, just before the COVID situation kept us from meeting in person. They said that they wanted to do additional studies to assess the elk migration pattern primarily. We were somewhat confused by that because Dr. Kramer had just, you know, spent 5 years doing extensive studies statewide pinpointing these high areas of wildlife vehicle conflicts. So in our view, let's place the wildlife mitigation components sooner rather than later. But the good news, you know, like Tom Fisher said earlier in this broadcast, you know, if they're planning on the 224 bus rapid transit, we can encourage them to combine wildlife mitigation components with this transit system, get an appropriate means for these animals to cross back and forth. Because why pay for law enforcement or highway patrol to monitor traffic twice a day while the elk are crossing back and forth? You know, it's a cost benefit analysis, and I think things can be done aesthetically and appropriately for the setting. You know, we don't want to have some huge overpass that's that can accommodate vehicles like over I-80. We don't want to have something like that on across 224. But we can do something, you know, more of a greenway, more aesthetically pleasing, that can blend in and be beneficial for the animals.
So has UDOT then used this time, this pandemic time, to actually do the studies, or just to as an excuse to kind of ignore you guys?
No, we haven't heard much feedback from them. So in our efforts to reach out, you know, they've done, there's some wildlife fencing repair, along I-80, as, you know, vehicles have hit the fencing, for example. You know, so they've, you know, we've been in correspondence with them regarding that, but as far as the study goes, they said that they weren't sure when it was going to start because they had to budget for it and actually get the specifics of the study laid out before it took place. So it's, you know, we don't know where they stand as far as their study goes. But in our view, something needs to be done sooner rather than later. You know, motorists are at risk. Wildlife, of course, are getting killed, and enough is enough. You know, we need to get the ball rolling on this. And as a segue to that, you know, I want to, on behalf of the group, I want to thank our community for the generosity during the PC Give PC. The generosity donations are continuing to come in, and we're more than appreciative because, you know, it's our efforts that started this whole process. You know, Save People, Save Wildlife, backed by the community, sat out alongside I-80 5 years ago and said, hey, UDOT, enough is enough. You got to do something. And they did. And, you know, we've met with them, you know, before the wildlife overpass was in place. We met with them on almost a monthly basis for months to hold them accountable. And, so, you know, and then true to their word, they put the overpass in and finished the fencing like they said they would. And, you know, we just need to finish I-80, get implementation of these wildlife mitigation components on 224 and 248, and get this community to have the respect and the safety components for the wildlife that a resort community such as Jackson Hole does. Why can't we be like a mini Jackson Hole? You know, they have the National Wildlife, the Elk Refuge there outside of town. We have the Swanah Preserve. You know, there are many analogies that can be made. And I think we need to up the ante and show a little more respect for the wildlife that helped make this a beautiful place to be.
Okay, so it sounds like for 2021, continue to raise money to continue doing the fencing that you think's needed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, if we can time the wildlife mitigation components with Summit County's plans for Kimball Junction renovation, for example, that, you know, that interchange there, Silver Creek Junction, 224, 248, it'd be the best use of donor dollars and taxpayer dollars to make it go as far as possible and get these gaps closed and get an established, reliable corridor. And, you know, again, we're still accepting donations like I alluded to before. In 2021, we're going to push to a more collaborative effort with Wildlands Network and use their knowledge so we don't have to reinvent the wheel so much. Moving forward as a collaboration of these working groups and nonprofits and be more efficient and get results in a more timely manner.
Okay. Erin, anything else you wanted to mention?
Again, thank you so much to everyone who continues to support us and has supported us in the past. And it's, you know, it just, I've heard from so many people that say every time we drive under that overpass, we just smile and know that, you know, even if you gave $10 towards the effort, you helped make it happen. So a constant reminder that this does work, and we need to perpetuate these successes, not just, you know, sit back and say, oh, we did such a great job. No, let's perpetuate the successes, keep things moving forward, and we'll all be better because of it.
Okay. Erin Ferguson with Save People, Save Wildlife. Thanks for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you, Leslie. Have a great day.
National Weather Service reporting minus 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I didn't know there was such a thing. Anyway, I've got 10 degrees here in Old Town Park City, kind of the banana belt of the area. We've got sunshine in the forecast, but cold. 22 is the expected high. Clear tonight. 10 degrees is the overnight low. Mostly sunny and 26 for Wednesday. Clouds moving in Wednesday night with snow likely on Thursday. In terms of accumulation, we're talking about less than an inch, so not a big deal at all. Things clearing on out of here by New Year's Day with sunshine and a high of 27 with perhaps another round of snow perhaps coming in on Saturday.
Hi, I'm Aaron from Esco Heating, AC, Plumbing, and Electrical, supporting KPCW. We can perform a heating system inspection or tune-up. More info at 855-ESCO-NOW or escoutah.com. That's ESCO, ESCO.
Utah has laid out plans for phase two of the COVID-19 vaccination, focusing on older Utahns while leaving essential workers out of the plan for now. The initial plan that was laid out in phase two included people over the age of 65, essential workers, and minority and ethnic communities. It also included those living in homeless shelters or those incarcerated. The Utah Department of Health unveiled a new plan for phase two yesterday with an emphasis on the older populations. Phase two of vaccinations will start as early as mid-February. The first part of the phase will focus on residents who are 75 and older. Utah Department of Health Interim Director Rich Saunders was quoted in a press release. He said phase two should focus on older populations because, quote, they're far more likely to be hospitalized, to need intensive care, and to pass away from COVID-19. Statistics show that adults ages 65 to 84 have a more than three times greater risk of being hospitalized, and that risk only increases for adults over the age of 85.
Hi, I'm Rachel Martin. It has been a hard year for many, public radio included. We are fighting to avoid cuts to this essential public service. Your donation now would help make up the difference. That in turn will help us keep reporting the news you rely on. NPR was founded as a public service, available to everyone. If you're able to donate to this station, please do so.
You can donate by going to our website, kpcw.org, and click on the donate button in the upper right-hand side of the screen.
It's KPCW Park City.